So I'll start off by chanting the four vowels. Anyone that knows it is welcome to join in.
Shigur Segan Mo On Shujo
I said on the email that I was going to speak about something. So Zen practice in daily life, it says here. So that's what we're doing today. What I wanted to do is say a little bit about the history of Zen, about what Zen practice has been like, or the history of Buddhism and Zen, what Zen practice has been like for thousands of years, and where that leaves us. And what it means for us. And I will say that what I want to speak about is very much, I'm not coming with answers. I've got questions rather than answers. Questions for us all to think about, and some ideas. But that's where it is, rather than sort of, okay, this is the way things are. Because, as you'll hear from what I say, I would say this is a historic time. So looking at it from the kind of the history of Buddhism and Zen. If you look back to the origins of Buddhism with the Buddha, it very clearly has always been a tradition which is primarily a monastic tradition, with nuns and monks carrying the tradition primarily. So in India, they would be mostly wandering on their own, practicing on their own, and coming together during the rainy season to come together in a kind of community for a period of 3 months during the rainy season, and then again going off out on their own, or maybe groups of two or three around the villages. When it came to China and Japan, the circumstances were a bit different for various reasons. It was harder in that culture to beg for a living, and it was a new religion there, so it didn't have the support that didn't have the cultural support that had in India. And so the nuns and monks started to farm and created monasteries and nunneries where they live permanently there, as opposed to being more wandering. And so you have these communities developing. And living both the kind of wandering practitioner of in India, and also the living in a community practitioner in China and Japan, brought with it a number of things. So the first things that it brought was very much a rhythm, the rhythm of life. It's something that the Tibetans call the mandala of practice. It was a rhythm, and it's true in any community, in a Christian community, whatever. There is this rhythm of practice that you simply let yourself go to. You don't need to worry about, are you going to go to the dojo this week? You just simply abandon yourself to that rhythm, and that rhythm carries you. Of course, your ego might struggle with the rhythm, but nonetheless, when you join the community, you've made a commitment to letting go to that rhythm. And so there's this rhythm that carries you, this rhythm that you live with. And some of that, if you go on a retreat with us, a sesshin, some of that you'll experience, whether it's a 3-day one in the UK or a 10-day one in France or whatever. Some of that you experience. You just simply need to follow the sounds. The sounds tell you what to do next. You don't need to worry about what time it is. You just follow the sounds. It tells you when to get up. It tells you when to go to the dojo to practice Zazen. It tells you when to eat. It tells you when it's time to work together to prepare the food. You just follow the sounds. And so you can just abandon yourself. So that's not true. Just letting yourself go to that rhythm can be very liberating. And also, not only is there a rhythm, but also there is a certain ritual of living. if you live in a Zen community, a Buddhist community, then particularly Zen, I would say even more so than some of the others, almost every part of daily life, whether it is waking up, whether it's going to the toilet, whether it's going to the dojo, whether it's preparing food, whether it's eating together, every part of life has a small amount of ritual in it to remind you, to be present to it, to remind you to be aware of what you're doing, to remind you that you're doing it as part of something wider, that you're part. And in a traditional monastery or nunnery, then, for instance, before you clean your teeth, you would do a very short chant, maybe in your head, not necessarily out loud, but you do a very short chant, which reminds you that doing your cleaning your teeth is looking after your body to allow you to practice. And so always, constantly, there is this reminder. And another thing that the monastic and the a convent community provides is the sense of sangha, which is the Buddhist term for the community itself. The sangha of people who practice together. You're with people who are all committed to a certain way of living, a certain direction in their life. And of course, finally, when you're in such a community, then you naturally practice regularly. You practice the meditation, practice Zazen regularly, once a day, twice a day, longer, during, more often during special periods. So you're always, you have that practice as part of your life. And so Buddhism was very much Harry. The Buddha said to people, you need to leave your families and come and follow me. And he did that. You know, he practiced what he preached. He wasn't a particularly good role model as a parent. But he practiced what he preached. And so it was primarily, it has always been primarily a religion, a practice of carried by the monks and the nuns. Nonetheless, that doesn't mean that it wasn't wider than that. It was something that connected with others. But traditionally, that was done in a different way. It wasn't done by everyone meditating. It was done by the monks and nuns carrying out ceremonies for the lay people to help them connect, to remember those who are dead, to honour those who have recently passed away, particularly in China and Japan, where the idea of a long family history is very important in Chinese and Japanese tradition, more so than in India. Also, the idea arose, which is not in the essence of Buddhism, but it's something that arose in the more general kind of Buddhist community, the idea of merit, that if you give money to a monk or a nun, if you give, then if you pay for a ceremony to happen, if you give food, then you get cosmic karma points, which you can cash in for better rebirths, that sort of thing. And so these ideas arose, and so the lay people were involved with the monks and nuns in these kind of ways. They didn't think that what they saw that for lay people, they saw that the purpose of their lives were to live in such a way that they would one day be reborn as a nun or a monk so that they could practice more. So rather than thinking that their lives themselves were to practice, they were thinking, okay, we've got to live a good life so that I can be reborn as a nun or a monk in the future. Dogen, who was the founder of Zen, who brought Zen from China to Japan, he wasn't the founder, but he was the one who brought Zen from China and Japan, and in some ways kind of radicalized it in certain ways. He was a great believer in connecting with the lay people, and what he did is he encouraged them to take the vows, the Buddhist vows, to take the vows, which were primarily about living your life in a good way and an aware way. But nonetheless, he wasn't encouraging them to meditate. He was encouraging them to take the vows. He was encouraging them to take what we call the bodhisattva ordination. And Gabby's wearing the rakusu there, which is the lay ordination. So he would encourage people to take that and to take the vows and engage in practice in that way. Think about how their life could manifest, be carried out in a more aware way, how their life could be carried out in a way which caused less suffering for them and for others. So he encouraged them to take on the Buddhist ethics. And there's a lot that can be said about that, and but I won't talk about it today, but maybe another day we'll talk about what that means from a Buddhist point of view. So that means in the East, it's been primarily a monastic tradition. It changed a bit in Japan about 100 years ago when they decided to allow monks, but not nuns, to marry. And so you got this kind of monk with his wife living in a temple, running it as a kind of... so becoming more of a temple thing rather than a monastic thing. And that was about 100 years ago. And so there's kind of this kind of temple priest lifestyle with the equivalent of the vicar's wife. There's the Japanese equivalent of the vicar's wife, who would kind of look after and take care of things together with the priest. So there were some changes around that time. But it's very different from, and this is why I say, I think, from in terms of Buddhism and Zen, we're living at a time of great change, because by it coming to the West, we are engaging with it in a very different way from how it was done traditionally. Far more people who come don't want us to carry out rituals for them. They want to learn how to practice. That's why people come here. They want to learn how to sit Zazen. They want to learn how to meditate and make that part of their life. And so this really started in the West in the 60s, I would say. In Japan, there wasn't a lot of interest from the lay community until there was the interest in the West. And now, in Japan, you find that temples are setting up sitting groups for Japanese people. But that wasn't true in 1950, say. Yeah, there was a few exceptions, but that wasn't true. It's something that's become... so they're kind of mirroring what's happened in the West to an extent as their culture changes and they see. So, but it means that... So there is a time of great change. And the question is, how do we preserve some of what the tradition carried in the temples, in the monasteries, in the nunneries, in our way of life? If it's just us coming to the dojo and sitting once a week, then that is not a bad thing to do, but that's not preserving the whole of the tradition. So that's the question that at the moment I am grappling with. Okay, so that's what I wanted to share with you. Yeah, what's worth saying? How can we bring some ideas of the life in a monastery, life in a community, into our daily life? Because clearly our lives are very different. We're struggling with many things. We have the joys and struggles of relationships. We have the need to make a living somehow. Struggling with the work we have, or struggling with the lack of work we have. You know, these kind of things. So, whereas in a monastery, you just abandon yourself. You don't need to worry about those things. We have ambitions to make things happen, to have an impact in the world in some way. Some of us have children, and we have the joys and the pains and the irritations that children bring, whether they're young or whether they're our adult children. And all of these things, to an extent, the monastic life avoids. And that's one of the reasons why the Buddha said, live a monastic life, because you can kind of avoid all those things. But I don't believe that Buddhism can be carried in the West in the way it was carried in the East by a purely monastic tradition. There are some people who do, like some of you know Jean-Pierre. Jean-Pierre, who visits the UK sometimes, he believes firmly in creating monasteries in the same way that they existed in Japan, in Europe, and he has one that some people who've visited describe as a little version of Kyoto, and he's made it very much like, and it is a beautiful place, from what I hear. I've never been there. And so he carries it in that way. But I believe that we need to create something that's more inclusive than what existed in Japan. And so that's the question that I'm struggling with. So I'll tell you some of the things that come out of this. The first thing is the question of home practice. So we come to the dojo. It's good to come to the dojo and sit. It's good to sit with other people. It creates a community. It creates... sitting with someone next to you is different from sitting on your own. Sitting in the dojo in a place where a practice is carried. This room has been sat in for over 20 years now. You know, La Jandonnière has been sat for longer than that. the temple in France. And it, on the pillar it says, may this temple stand for 1,000 years. So maybe it will, who knows? I don't think this will necessarily stand for 1,000 years. So it's good to sit in a place which has been sat in. It's good to sit with others, so it's good to be in the dojo. But nonetheless, our lives mean that we can't be here every day. We don't open every day. We open 5 days a week at the moment. We don't open every day. So our lives mean that we can't be here every day. So I believe it's good to practice at home. And that's slightly different from what Master Deshimaru said. Master Deshimaru, who brought the teachings from Japan to Europe, based in France, he really encouraged people to only come to the dojo and only sit at the dojo. And I believe the reason he did that is because he was dealing with a bunch of alcoholics, heroin users, in 1960s Paris, and he wanted them close to him. He wanted to get them off their heroin onto the whiskey, because that was better for them. That was his attitude. And so if people who are completely ungrounded are sitting regularly at home and sitting for hours, getting obsessed in the same way they got obsessed with it, then they are going to get a bit loopy. And so he wanted them with him so he could look after them. So it's not good to sit for a long time at home. It's not good to become obsessive. But I believe it's good to sit regularly at home for a short period of time, maybe 20 minutes or something like that. And I try to sit every day, not necessarily 20 minutes, but at least 5 minutes every day to connect with the practice in some way. It will be nice. So Jean Babi, who was one of the two founders of this dojo, together with his partner Nancy, he said, if you can't come to the dojo, it's nice to sit at the same time we're sitting in the dojo. It's nice to sit so that you feel some connection with those who are in the dojo. That's what he encouraged people to do. So that you still feel a link with the Sangha, with the community. So that's the first thing to say. So I believe that we need to find a way to encourage practice at home, but without allowing people to go off the wall and getting obsessed by it and going, because one of the dangers is if you practice on your own, a solitary practice can become an egoic practice. It can become an endurance test. It can become these kind of things. And so being in the community helps. Being with your peers and being with those who've practiced for longer than you helps you avoid those risks. But nonetheless, I think if you come to the community regularly, then practicing on your own is not a bad thing to do. That's the first thing to say. The second thing I was going to say is, how can we find some of the rhythm and ritual that the monastic living offers? How can we find that in our daily lives? I'll tell you some of the things that one of the things when we do, so Jeremy was saying it would be nice if maybe we did the traditional way of eating in the monastery more often in our dojo. It's something we do when we have retreats. But Jeremy was saying to me the other day, it would be really nice if together we did our the bowl ceremony together. We won't do it tonight, but maybe we'll do it sometime. I'll speak with Adrian. Maybe we can do it in Bristol a bit more. But how can you bring some of that? Because the bowl ceremony is to remind you that the food that you eat has been provided by all of existence. And it's come to you as a gift from all of existence. And you eat it so that you can give back to the world through your practice, through your awareness, etc. And so you eat it in a very aware way. And it's not easy, in our lives, it's not easy to do that. So, you know, if I'm trying to eat in a aware way, I've got, Dad, Mira's kicking me under the table, that sort of thing, you know. What I try to do is I try to have four mouthfuls, just four mouthfuls in silence before responding to the children or whatever. You know, that kind of thing. Just if I can manage four mouthfuls, that's a start. But trying to bring just some of that awareness. I don't think we can do the whole thing. We can't live a monastic life. You know, we can't live a life like that. But we can bring some of the awareness that tradition brings to the rest of our lives. Another one that I'd like to do, which is actually, I first heard from the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy movement, but it turns out it appears in 6th century Chinese monastery rules, and that is being aware when you brush your teeth. That's a nice time to be. Spend 2 minutes being a bit aware, you know, rather than spreading it around. Another one which certainly wouldn't appear in the 6th century monastic rules is trying not to be pulled by the email so much and trying to have a moment of awareness before you open your emails and respond to your emails, that sort of thing. So trying to bring some of these things so that we don't get caught up into the frenetic reactivity of Western life. Just finding things which cut through, trying to bring. So that's something that I think that the rhythmic temple life can offer us if we can find small ways of finding it in our everyday living. And the last thing is the community, the sangha. So traditionally, you would be living in a community where everyone around you is practicing. And of course, we work and live with people who have different priorities in their lives. And that's something we have to deal with, and that's absolutely fine. And part of the skill of what we do is to be with others, respecting their priorities while still keeping our centre and our priorities in what we do. And part of that is that's the other reason why Master Desh Shimura said it's important to come to the dojo, is because connecting with others who have a slightly different set of priorities from that which is mainstream in our society allows you to become more aware of the habits that mainstream society encourages with us, and allowing you to step outside them in ways which aren't which are subtle and not too in your face, so you can be quietly radical rather than having to be kind of some kind of huge disruptive, very different figure. You see what I mean? So you can. So I believe that Zen offers a kind of space of quiet radicalism in our society. So those are my thoughts. As I say, very much it's a question because, and I think I spoke about this last time I talked, they speak about how in Buddhist history they talk about what's called the turning of the wheel, and they talk about the great turnings, and the great turning of the wheel is when the Buddhist tradition innovates in some way, in a way which is respectful of its past. And those turnings always happen in times of upheaval in society and in the tradition. And it's very clear that one of those happened when Buddhism left India, came to North India, when Buddhism, what was called the Mahayana movement, was one great turning, which was about 500 years after the Buddha's birth. Another great turning happened when it went to China and Japan. Another great turning happened when it went to Tibet. This is when Buddhism changed but tried to keep some contact with its roots. And I think that this is happening again. I think that the Buddhism coming to the West is another great turning which will fundamentally change Buddhism. And part of our job is to make sure that that happens in a way which is not caught up in West's ego, caught up in what we want, giving us what we want, and is true to the tradition without being hidebound by by the structures of the tradition. So that's my kind of feelings about that, is that we need to find a way to make that happen. And when I say we need to find a way to make that happen, that doesn't mean, right, we need to struggle to make it happen. It means we need to just let it go through us and be aware that the great turnings are things that take 100 to 200 years each time. So I will never see the answer to this. The answer will play out in the next 100 years. And all we can do as people who practice is play our part sincerely, do our best to manifest the spirit in our lives. Okay, so that's, as I say, questions rather than answers. Questions and ideas rather than answers. Thank you all for listening. So we will stop now. I'm going to do a little chant, which is done at the end of teachings, and then we will break and we will have food.
Jishichai shikikun jiren kafu jashi shin shin jin cho ihihi kishurin bujo song.